Founders, welcome back to the Zero to 5,000 podcast, where we obsess over the convergence of human potential and business results. Today, our hosts Drew McClure and Jordan Mitchell have another insightful conversation for you. So let's jump right in.
Okay, founders, welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm joined by Kyle Rand. Kyle is the CEO and founder of Rendeavor, a company pioneering the future of aging with the use of virtual reality for seniors. And they are using virtual reality to create happier, healthier, and more connected lives. And to tell us about this is Kyle himself. So Kyle, thank you for being here, man.
Drew, I'm really looking forward to the conversation. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I am too. I love the mission. You know, I did some research myself on your background, saw the video on your website that was super inspiring. Also just love the adoption of technology. And so a creative idea, using virtual reality, helping out senior citizens. Where does this come from? Like, how does that even enter your mind as a company that needs to be started?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I find the most delightful about working in this space and on behalf of this demographic is we all have a connection to the aging population, whether or not it's through a grandparent, through a parent, another family member, a neighbor down the street, or the simple reality that every day we ourselves are getting older. It's really easy to look towards the future and say we should do something different. We should look to an aging process that can be one that's full of life and full of vibrancy and full of purpose. And there's a lot of work that we can do today to set ourselves up for success in the future. So I think that's one of the most remarkable things about this industry. I originally fell in love with senior living as a kid. So I used to spend a lot of time volunteering in a local senior living community where I'm from in upstate New York. I used to go and scoop ice cream for older adults, which I found to be just absolutely delightful. I also thoroughly enjoyed the free ice cream as a kid. And then I went to school and I studied cognitive decline in the aging population. So I got to spend a lot more time working with older adults from a research standpoint. And then ultimately my college career was bookended by losing both of my grandmothers for very different reasons. And I think when you see the aging process play out with someone that you care about, and when you get the realization that that affects not just that individual, but affects my family, or it affects everybody's families and everybody who's involved in setting that person up for a successful aging life, it's really hard to not want to get involved and change things. So we ended up founding Rendeavor back in 2016. So we're about to celebrate our 8th birthday, which is wild to think about.
Whoa. Yeah. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks. And I think the even cooler thing is that we are still doing the same exact mission that we started back in 2016. So we're really looking at the use of immersive technology, which is having a beautiful heyday, to help build more happier, healthier, more connected communities as we age. So we really take a social mental health approach. And as a result, we get to see some really beautiful moments created through Rendeavor.
Yeah. So when you first started in 2016, was it always the specific solution being virtual reality? I mean, that technology has grown in leaps and bounds in the last few years, or did it start off with a different approach or a variety of approaches?
It was VR first. So in 2016, okay. I don't know if you or any listeners remember, but that was when New York Times decided to send a whole bunch of Google Cardboard headsets to all New York Times subscribers. So right that time, everybody was having their first VR experience, which was taking a piece of cardboard, folding it into something that resembled a headset, slotting their phone in it, and putting it up to their head and be like, oh, this is VR. It was beautiful because, you know, everybody had this first experience, but it's also a little bit tough because your phone is not a VR headset, and trying to use your phone as a VR headset led to a lot of people having maybe nausea or motion sickness and didn't maybe fall in love with that first experience. Versus if you look at today, right, you try the Apple Vision Pro or you try the Meta Quest 3 or any of these modern headsets, it's magic the moment that you put it. So we've definitely benefited from the evolution of the hardware and the industry and the major tech players that are involved.
And how did you see the intersection of virtual reality and helping with the aging process?
For us, when we looked at VR, I think the simplest way to boil down the technology is it's a headset that you put it on and you can be anywhere doing anything. And if you contrast that to one of the realities of aging, which is at some point, right, there's some sort of limitation that could be physical, Oftentimes it's physical, where accessibility becomes more challenging. To be able to bring the entire world to someone where they're actively sitting or actively aging is just like a door opening experience in the purest way, which is why we ended up building out this tagline that is expanding worlds, because we look at the use of this technology to open the world back up to people who had that door closed.
I love that. And when I saw in the video too, that however, I'm assuming you've designed, you're not just like taking a pre-programmed thing that somebody else created and putting that in there. Maybe that's part of it, but it looked like you designed the experience itself, because several, you know, let's say several community members were also having the same experience at the same time. Is that right?
100%. And so really what we focus on in the mental health space is we focus on social mental health. And so if you're aware, the US Surgeon General this year announced that social isolation and loneliness were one of the biggest things to focus on. It's one of the fastest growing epidemics. Of course, that was exacerbated by the pandemic. But all of the data behind this actually originates with older adults. So a lot of the results and the reports and the outcome metrics that were shared in that report originated with older adult research. And so back in 2016, we saw just how clearly poor social health led to really detrimental things. So the comorbidity map for social isolation amongst the aging population, it has a tie to a 30% increase in risk of stroke.
Wow.
Increase in risk of heart disease, a 50% increase in risk of dementia. We're talking about diabetes. We're talking about immunosuppression. We're talking about depression, anxiety, and suicide. Collectively, it's as detrimental to one's health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It's very clear that the number one way to create a better structure for aging is to start with social health and start communities to form in more authentic ways and relationships to build in more authentic ways. And that's really where we see the opportunity for tech and for VR for this population.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. I remember I've said this several times before, but I don't think I ever knew the actual data to the physical health and the mental health of it. But I always said, like, how do you punish someone who's already being punished, right? Mm-hmm. You think about somebody is in prison. They're already being punished for a crime they committed. How do you take it a step farther? You know, you put them in isolation.
Yeah.
Isolation is just something that human beings do not thrive in. And I would imagine the older you get, like you said, the physical limitations, but then also the social limitations that you have, we're seeing a link to an acceleration of some of the issues they might be having already with old age. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really complex space to be isolated. And to me, someone spending hours or days alone where maybe they only have one social interaction per day, maybe it's a home care agent, so it's not someone who actually like really truly emotional and cares about that person in all circumstances. If they don't have access to people, the likelihood that they're going to fall short on their medication adherence, the likelihood that they're not going to work out or do any sort of physical exercise, which would lead to fall risk, the likelihood that they might not eat the healthiest things and they might resort to freezer food. There's all sorts of things that just like not having that human connection increases the likelihood of, which leads to compounding health impact. Which is why for us, it's like, how do we go right to the core of the issue, which is how do we build communities that people want to be a part of, not just like physically showing up in the communities, but emotionally showing up and building better human connections. And one of the first things we did is we did a study where we found that after 2 weeks of daily shared experiences using Rendezvous, we saw a statistically significant decrease in depression scores amongst participants and increases in a few different measures of social health. The one that I think is most interesting is we actually saw an increase in trust. So people started to trust each other more, they started to trust their staff more. And when we think about human connection, right, I have a lot of therapist friends, and one of the core components of connection is this ability to trust someone. If you can't trust someone, do you have an authentic relationship with them? How do you build that trust? A lot of oxytocin is based on trust. It comes down to what we believe is the foundation of human connection is positive shared experiences. How do we get people to sit down and laugh together, or sit down and smile together and have like this amazing reaction to something that otherwise could be so simple, but because they're reacting together, we can actually cultivate the beginning of a relationship.
Yeah, I've heard in neuroscience, they use this phrase that the things that fire together wire together.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you're already having this neural experience of having a very positive experience alongside these other people, that's kind of wiring together, that association of the joy, the fun alongside of the people that I was with, right?
Yeah, I love translating the neuro side to the human side, because it's true. If we can get people to laugh together, if we can get people to say, wow, at the same time, the likelihood that wow translates to a, did you see that, which translates to a, I used to love going to zoos as a kid, which translates to sharing of memories, which translates to understanding each other better. That's the opportunity with these moments.
Yeah, I love that. All right, the mission, beautiful, clear. Let's talk about the business side of it. Has this been an easy business to start and scale? Has it been challenging? What's that been like from 2016 until now?
I would say definitely challenging, which I believe is true of any single business.
Yeah.
If we again go back to 2016, VR was new. A lot of people's first experience with VR was less than ideal. And back in 2016, the idea of bringing technology to an older population was pretty uncommon. We've seen a huge rise in age tech since then, which has definitely helped. But I think we were facing a combination of issues from just like negative experiences with VR, negative perceptions of VR, compounding with pretty widespread societal ageism. And we had to battle both of those things while trying to build a business, which was a fun experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine the technology adoption, right? Like anyone can think about right now, there's something that your parents are like, ah, I don't want to mess with that. That's, you know, I don't feel comfortable using that. Mm-hmm. You go a whole another generation ahead of that and them saying, what is this thing? Right. So you have the technology adoption. Did you first have to sell, let's say, like the senior care facility first to like, that's the first customer you have to sell? Will you let us even come in and try this? How was that?
Totally. Totally. And I would say that, you know, senior living has started embracing innovation in a much more rapid way over the past 8 years. There were some communities that we called or like, do you want to try this? They're like, no, that doesn't sound even remotely like. And now it's like becoming ubiquitous among senior living. I think the other thing is that we realized right away that user experience was going to be everything for us. So we spent a lot of time understanding, you know, the process of aging is not an individual experience, right? Anybody who's getting older, they're going to have a family member who's taking care of them. They're going to have a whole family that is invested in their care. They're going to have potentially home care agents that are involved. They're going to have potentially senior living staff members that are involved, potentially hospice agents that are involved. There's a lot of people who really get involved. And that's, you know, you have your doctors, your lawyers, everybody else. And we had to really think through which stakeholder do we sell to? Yes. But which stakeholder do we design for? And that was the most important thing for us unlocking this industry in the early days. And if we didn't do that, I'm sure we would have never lifted off.
That's interesting. I like that. So not just who do I need to sell to, but even deeper, like who's really the person we're designing this for? How did you decide what that was for this product?
I think a number of user interviews, obviously. We learned a lot every time we picked up the phone and called somebody. And then we also, in our team, had experience with the aging population. Again, I used to work within these communities. I understood these communities pretty well. So got to combine past experiences with natural experimentation every time I picked up the phone to really build up a good approach.
What was year one like for you? If you were to look at this as a story, right? It's got different chapters. Like, what was year one like?
Ooh. You know, in my head, the moment you asked that question, I was like, which season of Game of Thrones was year one? I'd say year one was messy in every way. And like parts of it were beautiful, parts of it were painful. There was a lot that we didn't know. And there was a lot of differing opinions on what was possible and what was probable. And I think that caused a lot of turmoil and doubt, which is normal for any company.
Yes, the unknown. You're starting literally in the unknown.
Yeah. And people respond to that in different ways. And I think, you know, even at year eight, there are still things that are unknowns for us, right? Like, we're always looking to cross this chasm of uncertainty. And as we've grown the company, as we've onboarded new team members, it's been really interesting to see just how much variance there is in response to uncertainty. And I think one of the things that's become most important for me and our leadership team is the ability to coach amongst uncertainty.
Yeah. So how did y'all survive year one? I always come back to year one and year two, because it's statistically, it is the biggest gauntlet. It's not that there's not other areas for us to fail, but like statistically, those are the ones that most companies don't make it out of. How did you survive year one and two?
I'd say we benefited most from a really supportive community. So we actually had a couple co-founders leave the company during year one. And at that point, it was like a real serious moment of, what are we going to do? Like, is there validity here? And we luckily were part of a community that was ruthlessly dedicated to their companies and their portfolio. And I remember walking in one day to that community while we were going through this moment of massive uncertainty, and I was treated to a giant group hug. And from that group hug, we sat down and we just talked through like options and, you know, realities. And that was such a profound moment in translating pretty emotional uncertainty into more logical uncertainty, because there was that emotional support that was infused in the moment. Does that make sense?
Yes, 100%. Part of the fuzziness is just the emotional cloudy self-doubt, worry. I don't want to let people down. Do I know what I'm doing? And when you felt, it sounds like when you felt some of that emotional instability go away, I'm not alone. People believe in me. I'm not crazy. It just brought the logical side of, so what's the problem and what's the solution? Is that what it was?
100%.
Well, so is it venture backed? Is it a Y Combinator type thing? Like, What was that community you were a part of?
The community was Mass Challenge, actually. So we were the first cohort of what is today Mass Challenge Health Tech. Back then it was called Pulse at Mass Challenge. It was the first time launching a program really focused on digital health and health tech, based in Boston, where there's no better place to be building a digital health company. And I still stay connected to pretty much everybody from that team today.
Wow. That's so cool. So was it bootstrapped? Like, did you have to use your own capital that first year, or did you have an infusion of cash that helped you get a team early on? Like, how did this, where do we start? Cause you got tech involved. You got all sorts of stuff you're having to build.
We have the benefit of good storytelling deep in our roots.
So cool.
We always told a good story. And I think that's only possible because we're doing something really meaningful that resonates with a lot of people. As I said in the beginning, we all have a connection to the aging process. We all probably have some level of doubt about what aging can look like. And to be able to take that understanding and translate it into hope and opportunity and like real authentic joy in our storytelling has been probably our strongest suit since day one. Through that, we won a number of different pitch competitions. At Mass Challenge, we ended up winning the Gold Award, which was a 40K check, which was huge for us as we were
Heck
going
yeah.
Like sense of massive uncertainty. And then what we did is we focused on customers and bringing on early customers, early adopters, and learning relentlessly through each one of them. And so, rather than spend a lot of time on the VC route, we spent a lot of time with those early adopters. We would go dedicate resources to going on site, training them on site, spending 3 hours with them, learning as much as we humanly could to make sure we were always improving the post onboarding experience while learning about how to actually make the sales process work. And through that, we were able to win some really great contracts. And to this day, we're still looking at 95% retention rates.
Wow.
really beautiful. And it all started with like a really, really, really deep understanding that we have to understand, or a deep focus that we have to understand how this gets used in the real world and how we build a full customer journey that keeps the cycle moving in the positive direction.
In that early phase when you're working with the early adopters, were there any like fundamental pivots where we genuinely had to change like a full on how we were approaching it or what we thought we would work? Or was it, we were pretty spot on with what we thought this was going to be, and we just had to do some tweaks to the thing as we went?
I would say what we really ended up doing, and this is true of most companies, is we just got really good at what we were good at. And so being in a space where if you've ever worked in VR or you know someone who's develops for VR, there's so much that you can build.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of joy and wow. And you know, in the early days, we had a lot of people asking for X or asking for Y or asking for Z. And we were like, yeah, great. Let's pull it all in, pull it all in, pull it all in. And then we started identifying like, this actually isn't really in line with the mission. This isn't really in line with our approach to building this company. Or this is, and it's funny, like, as I say this, there are definitely people who've been a part of our journey, have seen what we've done. They're like, they actually build a lot. I don't know how focused they really are, but for us is like, we build things with efficiency and only if, like, we're really true believers in the MVPs, but also only if it aligns with the ultimate mission, which is building more authentic communities, for this population. And I think that was like the most important thing for us. So it wasn't so much a pivot. It was just a constant, like,
if you had like a, refining.
Yeah. Or like, if you had a block of wood, you knew what the mission was, what the product was, what the opportunity was, and someone threw a new block at you, being able to say like, oh, that's actually not the right wood type, and throwing it away.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine part of it would be deciding what, there's so many options, right? Like you said, like, especially as an emerging technology, there's so many features we could add in there. And the question would be, what's a gimmick versus what's essential to the experience we're trying to provide?
Yeah. And like, where do things align really well with sales? Where do they align really well with like customer experience? And how do we find the overlap there?
Yeah. How are you different today than you were 8 years ago?
Oh man.
These things, they change us. You can't help it. In awesome ways and some challenging ways, right? But where would you say you're different now?
8 years ago, I was 24 years old. So I couldn't even imagine. We've changed a lot as a company and me as an individual. I don't even know how to simplify that. Like, pretty much my entire professional career has been Rendezvous. I think one of the things that I've recognized that I needed to do early on was, with, you know, my relative lack of experience, relative youth serving a population that tended to be a little bit more old school, was I had to be relentlessly dedicated to my own personal growth. And to this day, like, I really believe that the only way to stay in my position is to constantly be leveling up in my opportunities within this position. So I have a great executive coach, which I absolutely love, but I spend as much time as I can reading, learning, understanding how other people are approaching their jobs within this org to figure out how I can coach and do better in the support role, as well as in the like cross-functional leadership role. And I would say when I was 24, I was 100% like just doing the things. Like, I
can, yeah.
That is to, in the early stages, that's kind of the role. It's just doing
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
And identifying as you bring in people and as you start trusting like the leaders that you're cultivating, understanding where you do still need to do the things and where you need to kind of step off and coach people to do the things has been a constant learning process for me that I just keep staying focused on.
Love it. I love it. And again, I know I'm asking you kind of deep questions that I want you just to free flow with me, right? So which of those changes as a leader has had the most disproportionate impact, highest ROI, whether that be for you and personally, like, man, this took so much pressure off of me, or it could be impact on the business. You know, you mentioned the switch that everybody has to make, going from, I did everything because I had to do everything to now I'm learning to lead people who are doing everything. Were there any other ones like finding your confidence or learning how to delegate, or I don't know what it might be for you?
I think the, well, let me rephrase the question and then I can go deeper a little bit. Do you know the book Multipliers?
Yes.
Me, reading that book was a really important moment in my growth as a leader, because as I said, like I was someone who fresh out of school, fresh out of a couple like great jobs, dove right into the founder journey, early stages, all about just doing the things, building the things, going as fast as you humanly can. Making that shift in mindset and kind of internal psychology, I think Multipliers is really like a foundational book where I always understood delegation. I always understood why it was important, always understood what it looked like, but I think actually cultivating a level of mutual trust in transferring decision-making process was not something that I had ever been trained or coached in. And like, as much as I read about it, as much as I like practiced it, it wasn't until I read that book that it really became apparent that like, it's an entire skill set of itself to cultivate that mutual trust. And where I had been like maybe frustrated in giving up decision-making power, I was then able to actually get really excited about transferring decision-making power.
What in particular did you learn? How did you develop that skill set that led to more trust in that passing off process?
I think for me, it was more of an internal like psychological shift where I was like, there's still things that I'm just doing, right? That I think will always be the case, where I needed to mark for myself, it is time to pivot from doing mode to like leadership mode. And with that internal marking, then I was able to really lean into the kind of things that are necessary for that decision-making process to move over, for trust to be cultivated, or for the kind of like questioning and answering that's necessary to build both of those things to feel like the actual focus. And it sounds so simple, right? Like we're all so good at putting on different hats, but for me, it was putting on a different mindset.
Yeah.
You need to be switched quickly.
Yeah. It's not easy. It's not easy. In practice, it's not, especially when the bigger the company gets, the more the stakes are in the thing that you know internally. I know I can do a good job at this. You know, there's an emotional component to delegation as much as there is a skill component to delegation. Both of those are difficult, right?
I think one of the things that helped in a less healthy way was there were moments where we were like, I feel like this is Groundhog's Day. Like, I don't want to go through the same like process because I already know what it looks like and it really shouldn't be me doing it. And I had to go through enough Groundhog Day moments to be like, this is why we don't just delegate tasks. We actually transfer responsibilities and cultivate equal approaches.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Yeah, we see this often where some people will say they're delegating, but in the pass off process, they've just found someone to micromanage and that frustrates people. Others don't know what they're doing. And so they go, fine, it's yours. And the person feels like, you didn't give me any blueprints. You didn't transfer any knowledge. And if somewhere in between, if we can, you know, slowly pass off to the person feeling really empowered, the way we always describe it is you have to slow down in order to speed up. It feels slower than you'd like at the beginning, but when you do it well, you speed up afterwards because you've really got somebody that knows what they're doing and you get to back away. Have you had a similar type experience with that?
Oh my God, of course. And I think like we've all been through each side of that spectrum, right?
Yeah.
Like times where we've all probably been interpreted as micromanaging when internally we're trying to do the right thing. And we've all probably been interpreted as like being too hands off when we're trying to do the right thing. And I think,
yes,
you know, what's been really important for me is just kind of embracing the opportunity to do it wrong or to get it wrong, ultimately be able to do it right. wish that I had been a little bit more open in like how I was trying to navigate that change earlier than I had been, because it created more natural opportunities to like receive the feedback on like what was translating well and what was being interpreted in a way that wasn't what I was really trying to do.
Yeah. Oh, this is huge. But so we didn't even get a chance to talk about this, but outside of the podcast, what I do is work with fast growing companies. I work with leadership and executive teams. And one of the things that I always tell someone, we might be in a coaching session, they see an opportunity. You're right. I need to try this way of delegating or whatever. And I always tell them, don't do this secretly. Like, just be honest. Tell them, here's my goal. I'm trying to pass this off to you. I'm going to try to go about it this way, but it might be clunky and I'd love your feedback. That transparency allows them to not, you know, to extend some grace and not rush to a judgment on assumptions, you know, and also to help you calibrate what you're trying to do with the reality of how it's being done. Is that kind of what you're saying?
100%. So spot on. And like the jumping to assumptions happens.
Yes.
The worst thing, because it's happened for us where what was an approach to change and growth in overall leadership felt more like us being pulled apart.
Mm.
Just being a little bit more transparent about this shift up front totally would have been like, okay, like we're working on this together. And like I said, I think that was the most maybe blindsided lesson that I've had to learn over the past few years. It's like just being upfront about the shift while making the shift would just make everything so much easier.
Yeah. Or, you know, let's imagine you weren't hitting sales numbers and behind the scenes, people didn't really know, hey, cash is dwindling down and we're facing 8 months from now being out of business. Most founders keep that to themselves, start trying to implement initiatives and save the business. But all they think are, does he not trust me anymore? Why is she doing this? Like, are they just trying to get more money out of us? And they make all these assumptions instead of, and it's not that we have to share every detail. Some things may need to be private, but to some degree say, hey, we're feeling a lot of pressure here. We're really under the gun with some sales. And so we're going to try some things, but we can eliminate conspiracy theories if we actually tell them what the truth is.
I think that, and also supplementing it with the cultivation of just like a hypothesis driven culture, right? Ultimately, in order to grow, like, I mean, this is where OKR processes come in. This is where like pivots come in. If we're trying to identify, this is what we believe will work, this is our why, this is what we're not sure of, this is the test that we're going to run to do it. If we can cultivate that culture, the company is going to benefit for sure. And also, if we build in the right level of transparency, it makes it clear why, oh, we might want to experiment a little bit faster on this side to just get that alignment together.
I like that. Is that like a core tenet of something you guys have tried to do intentionally, or something you've just kind of found has accidentally been a part of the culture that's been really helpful?
I think it's another one of those like open transparency things for me. It's, to me, like my background's in research. Like I love testing things. I love experimenting with things. When I look at like anything on our marketing stack, marketing, I think, is the most beautiful place where you can run experiments that are super quick, that are super controlled. You can actually control the speed of them based on the budget that you want to throw at them. Like I love the capabilities of that in marketing. I think that same mindset translates to any different department. And it's been kind of a recent shift where I'm trying to bring that language into the team more openly about like, okay, what hypothesis do we think we really need to test to get to a better decision and to lead to maybe an efficiency or an optimization or making our team more happy, whatever it is, there's probably something to test. And being more open and bringing that language into the company, I think is.
How has that gone so far?
Great. I think one of the like wildest things to learn over the years is that, I mean, it's so easy to talk about the power of language and the power of word choice and the power of communication. Where I've seen it most clear is if we try to cultivate a new mindset or a growing mindset, and we pick three words and we really start bringing them into every conversation, they really do spill out throughout the org. And I love that. And also, it needs to be handled very, very, very closely to make sure you're bringing in the right words.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you think about that? Is it more like getting an awareness of the season. You know, what season are we in? What's most relevant to us right now? Versus just like word banking three random things we get introduced to our culture.
I think what we try to do is match it with the stage we're at as a company, right? Like we're at this beautiful stage where we're not so much trying to figure out the go-to-market. Like we have nice product market fit, we have nice sustainable growth. So now it's like, how do we change the culture to acknowledge that, right? Like now the things that we're talking about are, okay, how do we scale? How do we drive efficiencies? Like how do we provide more value in a way that really is ROI focused? Whereas not that long ago, it was like, how do we prove this very basic like business fundamental? Now it's all. And I think matching the language to the stage of the company more so than the season of what we're dealing with feels easier to lean into.
So stage-wise, you feel like you've started to come out of that early stage of still trying to find product market fit, still trying to even get your foot in the door type of thing. And now it's more, we've figured something out. Let's acknowledge we have. And how do we put some gasoline on it?
Yeah, 100%. I think that acknowledging that we have is the big one, right?
Yeah. Because that's a confidence builder to acknowledge we figured something out here. We're not guessing anymore, right? So what do you think at this point is the gasoline? How do we take something that's working and actually get that into more places?
So there's so many answers to this. And I'm like thinking through our leadership team and I'm like, this person would answer this way. This person would answer this way. This person would answer this way. I'll touch on a few. I think it's hard to deny the fact that AI is gasoline in and of itself. And where they really wanting us, especially after all the financial turmoil of last year, where I want us to stay focused on is this like embracing of frugality, not to borrow Jeff Bezos's word, but I think embracing frugality and thinking like scarcity mindset can be a benefit as we go into this next phase forces us to think about where are we driving efficiencies? What are we doing that's not optimal? Where are we spending time that really isn't providing the kind of ROI for the time within our internal team that we want? Like a great example, we have 8 hours of live sessions a day per Rent Never Live right now. Rent Never Live is our live programming feature. It's growing by triple digit increases every single year. People are really loving it. We just launched a big expansion where we more than doubled the amount of programs that we're running. One of the things that our team faces is if we have an external host cancel last minute, it's a mad scramble. And so we brought the team together and we're like, okay, like not only is this maybe every time a host cancels, it's an hour of just coordination. It's also mental energy that's going in action. And so if we acknowledge it's not just an hour, but it's more than that because of the mental exhaustion, mental fatigue, then clearly we need to change it. And, you know, let's look at other businesses like shift management tools abound everywhere. They're super cheap. What if we just took that approach to say, how do we remove the mental lift from this, the emotional lift from this, which would then make our internal teammates happier and able to stay focused on the things that matter more? Whereas it could be a total solution that you're just like, well, let's just like throw X money at this thing to make it better in that way. And I think focusing that conversation on ROI, on efficiency, on optimization makes us all better and will make the value of each dollar stretch a lot farther. And
yeah,
have to think about those dollars in a way that matches more with the stage of the company that we are, which is growth oriented.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, the way I've thought about it is like, kind of double bouncing your growth where, you know, if you think about like, just as a person, like, how do I have more money in the bank? It's like, you got one obvious option, which is to go make more money. Right. But if you're making more money while also getting better at spending less money, you have like doubled the impact of making more money. that money is just, it's like it goes so much faster towards the goal than just, we keep making more money, but we're really good at spending it too, right? That's demoralizing. We're like, yeah, we doubled our revenue, but we barely moved our profit margins. You're like, oh, that sucks. That was a lot of effort for a little return, right?
And so much of like the startup mentality has been spend, 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 grow, grow, grow.
Yes.
And I think the beauty of the turmoil of last year, just looking at Silverline, because it was awful for so many, is that the whole industry has shifted towards smarter spending habits.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had several tech companies on here. I've had investors on here, and they all talked about the getting back to the basics. Mm-hmm. They were like, one of the great resets was like, are we doing the basics? Like, do we have a profitable business? Or at least will it be profitable in a reasonable amount of time versus just the thought like, well, just money will never stop coming in. And so we can outrun these issues forever as long as we just keep growing. It's like, there is no infinite growth. Mm-hmm. There, at some point, you're going to have to reckon with, did we create a sinking ship that just outran the water? Or did we actually have a floating vessel that can survive on its own, right?
We've all made mistakes on the side of spending, right? Like I even think back to right before the financial turmoil really hit March of last year, we had brought on a couple hires and all of a sudden things shifted and we had to devote so much like strategic thinking to the financial turmoil. And what we missed in that was thinking really clearly about how to optimize the resources that we just brought in. And so that's like, I feel like the folly of business. But if we can stay focused on really optimizing any of our internal resources, whatever that is, through tooling, through AI, through leveling up, through providing more like mentorship opportunities, we're just going to be better collectively.
What's the size of the team now?
We're just about 30 internally.
Okay. Gotcha. So you're still in somewhat of the early, not early stages of business and all that kind of stuff, but as a team formation and of really even the growing of responsibilities and all that kind of stuff, you're still on that earlier side, right? I'm curious if you're seeing is from, I've done like 300 plus of these interviews. So I just have a lot of kind of anecdotal data points. Plus the companies we work with, but right around 30 is where they start to see a shift from 30 to 50 seems like a shift from organic to organized, where before that organic actually was an asset. Like, hey, let's be fluid. Let's not have too many systems and processes weighing us down. And then right on like 30 and beyond, you start to feel a felt need of like, I think we need to do this the same way every time. I think we need a process here. Has that started to happen already?
Yeah. So we're actually somewhere between 30 and 35 right now. And so we hit 30 probably middle of last year. And that was when it was like that shift really just actively happened. And, you know, where I'm sitting, I love the organic. I love
yeah.
the kind of messy side of building a company. But I don't love the impact of unorganized at the scale that we're at with the team right now. And I don't love that side enough to bypass my love for the organic side and say, okay, like let's actually dedicate as much as we can to changing this, which goes back to an earlier point, which is just like, there are different ways to influence a shift in leadership style. It can totally be positive. It can totally be like removing pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it makes sense that early on, you're not going to have as much pain because there's not as much demand. And it's like, yeah, we didn't drop as many balls because there were enough of us to catch it before it hit the ground. But you start getting an influx of employees, an influx of customers, you know, the amount of demand on your system, even it exposes some of those, like, we're not getting away with it like we used to. Like, you know, the ball is being dropped and dang, I think we need to have a system in place to make sure that doesn't happen. Right. But that sucks at first. Cause you're like, part of you misses the good old days when we didn't have to do that. And there's a growing pain. We call it like the awkward teenage years of like, there's some growing pains into who we really can be. Have y'all started to feel that growing pain?
Of course. I mean, I would say we felt growing pains every single month of every single year since.
Yeah. Yeah. Different kind of growing pains.
Yeah, they're just always different. And, you know, we've been really clear since day one about hiring people who embody grit and who embody resiliency and embody passion for what we're doing. Because the semi-quote Angela Duckworth, you can only really be gritty if you're passionate about what you're what you need to be gritty about. And because of that, we've been able to like navigate each growing pain with cultivation of just like being better, whether that's being better leaders or being better contributors or being better just humans, and how we show up in the workplace. And that's been really beautiful to see. And also it would be really nice to have less pain. I think it's just part of business.
Yeah. I mean, one of my neuroscience friends says, you got to understand at the basic level, your brain just wants to either move you towards pleasure or away from pain.
Right.
He's like, that's it. You're doing one or the other. I see an opportunity for more pleasure, more growth, more opportunity, or I see somewhere I'm in pain that I don't want to be in pain anymore. And so let's get me out of that pain. I think it's kind of similar in business too, right? The difference is that's packaged into bigger purpose. And it's packaged into bigger mission that maybe keeps those from being out of balance, chasing something that's unnecessary or not part of the mission, right?
And I think it's really interesting also with where we're at as a team is our early team knew our mission through and through. It was everything, right? It was everything we ever talked about in every single conversation. And like, as you're building the blocks, the mission is like there front and center all the time. As you're building the processes, the mission's not always there screaming at you, right? And like finding ways to bring that mission in, finding the right way to bring impact in as you're talking about things like optimization and efficiency. It's hard, but it's so freaking important.
Yeah. I mean, just think about the reality of bringing in somebody later into the conversation. So employee number 35 is entering the company conversation at a much different point and missed out on the context of why we're doing this. And so you have to then think, how do we teach somebody why we're doing this? Early on, it was just osmosis, just being around each other. And the things we were naturally talking about built that culture. Employee 35 is like, I just got here and we're talking about efficiency. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where they're entering the conversation. And it's like, no, we're talking about efficiency in light of all this other stuff. That's what I imagine is going on.
Totally. And I just got advice a couple months ago from a partner, actually, one of the groups that uses for Endeavor. Where we are, it's important that I'm actually super involved in the onboarding process. And now as we're onboarding a couple of team members, like I am taking that onboarding presentation where we talk about our mission, we talk about our past, we talk about our history, we talk about the why, and I'm leading that conversation because I think hearing it from the horse's mouth is far more beneficial from it being another point coming from the hiring manager.
Yeah.
Through all the stuff like process and efficiency and like metrics.
Yeah, game of telephone. For now, if you can get rid of the game of telephone, that's always going to be best, right?
Get rid of the game of telephone forever.
In general, right? Well, final question. What's got you most excited right now about the future of this company?
I think there's a lot to be excited about with where we are. We have a lot of tailwinds that are happening. So the overall embracement of technology amongst this population is just moving in the right direction. The ecosystem, the community around age tech as a whole has really blossomed in such beautiful ways. The salience of loneliness and social isolation as a topic for society to be looking at is just like top notch right now. It's not just the older adult population. I think it's something like 71% of people between the age of 18 and 25 are significantly lonely, according to the study. So we have like generational loneliness as something that we need to address. And we have VR entering, and I hope to be one of the most beautiful hype cycles that it's had, where we have a lot of these big players like Lenovo and Qualcomm are coming in with this, with these great headsets and these great approaches. We have Apple launching their first headset. Meta keeps moving, Pico keeps moving, HTC keeps moving, and there's so much beauty in the industry growing together that I'm just so excited. And then we're also entering this new phase of our deployments where we're really looking to kind of revolutionized the way that senior living works and senior communities work outside of the more controlled settings that most of our enterprise deployments have been. And we just wrapped a 3-year clinical trial 2 weeks ago. And the outcome of that data and everything that we learned just through running the operations of that study translate really neatly into how we're looking at the next couple of years. And
wow.
Can't wait to take it from the R&D stage to the commercial scale stage, because every conversation I'm having with partners or industry influencers right now makes it super clear that what we're doing is just exactly what we need.
Yeah. Super exciting. Heck yeah, man. Well, whenever I get to interview a founder like you that is bright, successful, but also doing something that really matters in the world, I'm just happy you exist. I'm happy someone's out there building a business that's not just for profit, which profit's fine, but is also doing something that is meaningful and needed in the world for especially our loved ones. So thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for being here on the show today.
Thank you. I'm a firm believer that you can build a profitable business that provides massive value to society. And I hope that we get to keep proving that. So
you're doing it already. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you, Drew. Appreciate you.
Founders, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and hop into our monthly founder email so we can ensure you stay on the edge of peak performance and massive business results.